Because I think in 10 years from now,
the thing that's going to be written about Seattle,
the thing that's going to be written about Seattle,
is not what tear gas bomb went off on what street corner.
It's not what tear gas bomb went off on what street corner.
But that the WTO in 1999.
But that the WTO in 1999.
Was the birth of a global citizens movement.
Of a global citizens movement.
For a democratic global economy.
For a democratic global economy.
The United States lost over 3 million manufacturing jobs, nearly a quarter of all steel jobs, and 60,000 factories after China joined the WTO.
The 22 richest men in the world have more wealth than all the women in Africa. The world's richest 1% owns more than twice as much wealth as 6.9 billion people.
Yesterday, 137,000 people escaped from extreme poverty. That could have been the headline in the New York Times every day for the last 25 years. Why wasn't it?
We're connected on a planetary scale. The same process that has allowed the coronavirus pandemic to spread so far, so quickly, globalization, also means that all our resources, our infrastructure, our food, energy, clothing, our electronic devices, almost everything human-made that we see around us contains some component that someone from somewhere else has worked on. Our economy is global. It affects not only every human, but also every animal, our climate, and every aspect of our environment. Yet, most media coverage of the economy focuses on the national level, and when problems like global inequality, poverty, or underdevelopment do get attention, they're often treated as the result of natural forces, or as resulting from corruption or bad governance in developing countries. In this episode of Our Voices, we want to dig deeper into the structures of the global economy to understand why it is that some parts of the world have so much more wealth and power than others. We ask whether the global economic playing field is rigged in favor of rich countries at the expense of lower income countries, and if so, what can be done about it?
For most of human history, life expectancy at birth hovered around 30 years. But today, it is more than 70 years in the world as a whole, more than 80 years in the more fortunate developed parts of the world. 200 years ago, no more than 10% of people in the world lived above the line for extreme poverty. Today, more than 90% do. For most of human history, everyone was illiterate. Today, more than 80% of the population is literate. Fewer people are dying in wars. Fewer people are starving to death. Fewer people are dying of infectious diseases. So as the world gets better and better, the coverage gets more and more negative. Of course, there are problems, and many of them are horrendous. But acknowledging the world's progress is not a matter of having a sunny disposition or wearing rose-colored glasses or seeing the glass as half full. It's paying attention to the data, paying attention to the hard, cold, objective facts.
Before the coronavirus pandemic, it was often claimed by public figures and academics, including Steven Pinker, that humanity has never had it so good, with a billion people lifted out of extreme poverty in the past 25 years, and the economic miracle of China showing that globalization benefits everyone. On the other hand, globalization has come under growing criticism from the right recently, with claims that it has disadvantaged the working classes of the US and Western Europe, some of the richest regions of the world, to the benefit of emerging countries where manufacturing jobs have been outsourced. This has led to the emergence of tariff wars and Donald Trump's determination to make America great again.
The United States lost over 3 million manufacturing jobs, nearly a quarter of all steel jobs, and 60,000 factories after China joined the WTO. And we have racked up $13 trillion in trade deficits over the last two decades. But those days are over. We will no longer tolerate such abuse. We will not allow our workers to be victimized. our companies to be cheated, and our wealth to be plundered and transferred.
Then again, back in the 1990s and early 2000s, globalization was under attack from the left for basically the opposite reason. The global justice or anti-globalization movement gained mass attention during the 1999 Battle for Seattle against the World Trade Organization. The movement argued that the world economic order was stacked in favor of rich countries and corporations, allowing them to extract value from the global south while outsourcing environmental harm. Walden Bello is an academic and former politician in the Philippines and was a leading figure in the global justice movement. He describes how the promise of free market globalization in reality led to destruction and mounting poverty and inequality.
It emerged out of a debate, first with institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund that were in the forefront of the market-driven development paradigm or the free market paradigm. And this debate intensified with the emergence of the World Trade Organization, its founding in 1995. And what this paradigm and these institutions were pushing is that the more market, the better, the more efficient the economy will be, and therefore the higher the growth, the less poverty, and eventually the less inequality. And this was very much associated with transnational corporations that were seeking to bring down market barriers, investment barriers that characterized many of the economies of developing countries. And basically what we were contending was that the opposite was happening, that the more you liberalized, as they called it, the greater the poverty, the greater the inequality, and the more economic stagnation there was.
According to Oxfam's latest report, the world's 2,000 billionaires have more wealth than the 4.6 billion people who make up 60% of the planet's population. Between 2017 and 2018, the wealth of the super rich grew by $2.5 billion per day on average, while the bottom half of the world's population saw their wealth decline by $500 million a day over the same period.
The 22 richest men in the world have more wealth than all the women in Africa. The world's richest 1% owns more than twice as much wealth as 6.9 billion people. The economic cost of women's unpaid care work globally for those aged 15 and over is at least $10.8 trillion annually, basically three times the size of the world's tech industry.
It's also important to remember that the poorest people in the global south tend to be a lot poorer than the poorest in the global north. According to the World Bank, even the economic miracle that's China has a per capita GDP of around $9,000, while in the US it's $60,000. In Uganda it's $600. And inequality within developing and emerging countries has risen even more than in developed countries. While the mainstream narrative to explain these imbalances focuses on corruption and bad governance in lower income countries, others claim that the rules and structures of the world economy are rigged in favor of rich countries. From this perspective, it's impossible for the so-called third world to catch up, because the wealth of the first world is achieved at the expense of the underdevelopment of the third world. One's gain is the other's loss. These global imbalances function through a mix of state and corporate power. Transnational corporations are the big winners in today's global economy. They seek to operate above national borders, and this is how they come to exert pressure on elected national authorities, extract value from across the globe, and avoid paying taxes. However, while these corporations are transnational, most are headquartered in the triad of the US, Western Europe, and Japan, and nation states tend to push the interests of their own large corporations. Economist Jayati Ghosh describes this kind of globalization as a new form of imperialism, which replaced earlier forms of imperialism that were more based on direct conquest and domination. Ghosh spoke to me about some of these global rules and regimes, beginning with the rules on intellectual property set by the World Trade Organization, or WTO.
The most evident legal agreements are, of course, those that come from the multilateral things like the WTO, for example, intellectual property rights. Now, the proliferation of different kinds of intellectual property rights, patents on all kinds of things, different kinds of trademarks, different kinds of industrial design control, and so on, all mean certain companies, usually based in the developed world, can control technologies and control knowledge. And sometimes all kinds of things are treated as intellectual property right, which are not even necessarily knowledge that these companies have created. Let's say farmers using seeds in southern India. They have traditionally used these seeds, but now they're told that, well, no, the patent over this particular type of seed is held by a multinational company and you have to get their permission before you can plant. Farmers would traditionally keep aside a part of their harvest to use as seeds in the next year, especially for a lot of, you know, grains and things that, bear their own seeds. But now they're told, well, no, that is infringing on the intellectual property rights of a particular company.
Another important area in which the global economic architecture privileges transnational corporations in ways that drain resources away from the global south is through tax avoidance.
Now, that's another very big thing. It's another way in which the international architecture really almost encourages multinationals to prey on the rest of society. You know, now we have these global corporations and they basically can choose when and where and if they will pay taxes. Now, how does that work? It works because multinational corporations typically tend to set up offices in the jurisdictions or countries that have very low taxes. That's no surprise. But the surprise is often, which are these tax havens? Everybody thinks that the really bad tax havens are all those little islands, you know, like Cayman Islands and Panama and stuff. But they're not the worst offenders. The worst offenders are the UK, which has Jersey, Guernsey, and all these Channel Islands, which are tax havens. The Netherlands, which is a very major tax haven. Switzerland, which is a very major tax haven. Ireland, which is a very major tax haven. And some states in the United States, like Delaware and so on, which actually have very, very low tax rates.
In all these cases, corporate lobbyists play a key role in making the rules and in deciding how they'll be applied. Attempts to correct some of these imbalances, for example, subsequent changes to the rules on intellectual property or agricultural subsidies, are often watered down or contain small print that ends up failing to solve the problem. Within the WTO, there's a mechanism by which countries can resolve investment disputes with each other. However, these again can be skewed, with powerful countries fighting for their big corporations. And treaties negotiated outside of the WTO, like NAFTA and its replacement, or bilateral treaties, often contain investor-state dispute settlements, or ISDSs, which mean that corporations can even take governments to court directly. Academic and activist Raj Patel tells us more.
And that's one of the greater dangers of trade agreements. When you hear trade agreement, really what you're hearing is mechanisms for companies to sue. And that's why they're very keen on these trade agreements. And, you know, while the US has stymied the World Trade Organization by not appointing any new judges to its dispute settlement body, the USMCA is a renewal of that kind of commitment to ensuring that there are ways for companies to get their pound of flesh. And sometimes, the trade agreement issues are very tightly intermeshed with what the World Bank and the IMF are up to. When low-income countries and former colonies find themselves heavily in debt, they have to cede sovereignty to the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And the IMF and World Bank will offer helpful solutions like, well, why don't you chop down this forest and export it? Or why don't you get this oil out of the ground and sell it on the international market for dollars, then use those dollars to pay back the loans that you owe us? And those kinds of ostensibly well-meaning, sound macroeconomic advice ends up being just a way for foreign investors to deepen their hold on local economies, but also allow a dominant bourgeoisie to get itself involved in the natural resource economy and to freeze the status quo of a developing country or a country in the global south in a way that perpetuates the misery not only of its working class and of its indigenous people, but locks entire countries into these sort of post-colonial relationships of domination.
Indeed, many of the rules of the global economy are not made in publicly accountable spaces, but behind closed doors in lawyers' offices. This is particularly true when it comes to finance. Jayati Ghosh explained how the rules of finance are made in the jurisdictions of just two cities.
So global finance now is governed by all kinds of rules. And the rules that matter are really the rules of only two places in the world, London and New York. These are the rules that govern the way finance operates everywhere in the world, whether you're talking about Ghana or Brazil or Vietnam or anywhere. And how did that happen? It really happened because all the capital flows, they all demand different kinds of guarantees. So let's say you're lending. So let's say you're a bank that actually provides loans to somebody in the developing country. You will insist when you're drawing up the loan, the legal validity of that loan is with reference to a particular set of laws. And 95% of these are the laws of the City of New York and the City of London. And that's partly because both of them have got big financial lobbies, Wall Street and the City of London. But it's also because these jurisdictions are really, really favorable to capital.
For Ghosh, basic steps can be taken to correct these extreme global imbalances, what she calls imperialism gone wild. People can get together to put pressure on their governments to get out of unfair trade and investment treaties and push for mechanisms to resolve sovereign debt. There are also practical ways to start tackling tax avoidance. Ghosh is part of a commission that advocates a unitary tax on multinational corporations, so that each country gets its fair share, no matter what accounting tricks companies try to play. Economist and politician Yanis Varoufakis has in recent years been at the forefront of calls for a new global economic architecture. He suggests updating alternative proposals put forward by John Maynard Keynes at the 1944 Bretton Woods Conference, where new rules for international trade were established in the wake of the Second World War. At the heart of this vision is an international clearing union that would help balance global financial flows. Varoufakis spoke to me about the clearing union.
So the idea of a clearing union is really very simple. God forbid, we don't want a common currency in the sense of all of us having the same money in our pockets. But what would be nice to have, and this is the basic idea of John Maynard Keynes from 1944, which we are now updating, massively updating, is that we have a common unit of account. And all our trade is denominated that common unit of account. It's not American, it's not British, but it is something like a synthetic currency to which all of us contribute. And imagine a situation where all trade is denominated in that, and where we have an agreement that any country that has more than a certain percentage of its GDP in deficit or a surplus is taxed a little bit per transaction. And all that goes into a common fund from which we invest in parts of the world where they need investment in order to rebalance, both in terms of the environment and in terms of financial transactions. That's the basic idea. That would work instead of the dominance of the dollar and Trump. The International Clearing Union is not going to fix everything. What it's going to fix is a tendency of global capitalism to create imbalances which then blow up, and you have huge austerity in certain countries and problematic growth in others.
The Clearing Union is part of an ambitious wider plan to transform global capitalism that also includes national investment banks, changing property rights, and a global universal basic dividend.
We need public investment banks to grab the excess liquidity, the excess money, and put it into good use in technological change that is amenable to the green transition that we all need. And thirdly, very importantly, changing property rights. So we have a proposal for a universal basic dividend, not income. We think that let's start with 10% of all shares of large companies should go into a global equity fund from which the dividends that accumulate then are distributed in the form of a universal basic dividend. So everybody gets the same because in a sense, we have created that capital together. You increase this from 10 to 20 to 30%, eventually you end up with a market-based socialism.
Walden Bellow has another vision for transforming the global economy, what he calls deglobalization. In these times of Donald Trump and trade wars, the term deglobalization can bring to mind images of isolationism and aggression. But Bellow's vision arose out of the global justice movement and is based on ideas of embedding the market into community values instead of communities being held hostage to the markets. Production for domestic markets, economic democracy, and living harmoniously with the environment.
Well, we were arguing this at a number of dimensions. At the ethical, philosophical level, we were saying that you could not let market drive society. And what we were calling for at that level was re-embedding the market in society. At the economic level, at the domestic market level, we were calling for stronger state protections in terms of safeguarding human welfare. And also as a corollary, we said that civil society needed also to be a restraint on the state to really make sure that democracy flourished. At the international level, we were saying that we really needed very important protections for the domestic economy, for the domestic market, which meant that we favored tariffs, we favored regulations on trade that were not merely just health regulations, but regulations that would control the destabilizing effects of imports, for instance, on the domestic economy in terms of bankrupting industries and therefore created tremendous unemployment. And we also said that you really needed very strong controls on investment so that transnational investors wouldn't end up taking over the economy. So that we were saying we really need to put a series of safeguards to protect the national economy and the national market. So this perspective did not mean, as many people who were very critical of us, to interpret this as saying that we were thinking about delinking our national economies or the domestic market from the international economy or from the international market. No, we weren't doing that. In fact, we were for a healthy integration into the international economy, a healthy balance between the international economy and the domestic economy.
According to environmentalist Ashish Kothari, to really get to grips with global economic injustice, we need to challenge not just corporate-driven globalization, but the entire idea of economic development. From this perspective, development itself is a form of neocolonialism that has wreaked havoc on both people and planet. Kothari began by telling me what development has come to mean.
So essentially what it has meant across the world is three or four things. One, that material progress is very much needed for this path of development. Every country has to go through this in order to. So that means more exploitation of nature, more exploitation of labor, and so on. Secondly, it means everybody has to move from being traditional to modern. So this whole modernity, project of modernity, is really about, you need to basically mold yourself in the way that the United States or Europe has molded itself. It meant also that it was okay for nature to be exploited and people to be exploited because eventually everybody would benefit, supposedly, from this project of development. And it therefore meant that if industrialization was happening at the expense of somebody or something, some species or some other human beings, it was all fine. If you look at, for instance, Margaret Thatcher and her famous dictum, there is no alternative, It meant that's the only way to go. And we've all been kind of sold this image and this dream that if we do this, we will all be prosperous, we'll all live the American way of life, etc.
Kothari argues that we should abandon the idea of development and instead embrace post-development. The field of post-development argues that there are already existing alternatives to development, ways of organizing societies that respect both autonomy of communities and the environment. For Kothari, there exists a wide diversity of economic and political systems that provide positive alternatives to development, but they share some basic universal principles.
At the core of this diversity, there is a common thread of values, of ethics, of saying the economy should be based on caring and sharing, not on greed, of saying that I will live my life and I will assert my identity, but as part of a collective and be responsible to that collective. So collectivity or commons instead of selfishness and privatization. So there's a whole bunch of these, you know, generosity, diversity of autonomy, of freedom, of simplicity, values and ethics that kind of show themselves in one way or the other in these different examples.
These alternative ways of being, in some cases, survive from the past, and in others emerge in the present. An often cited example of an older tradition that provides an alternative to development is the indigenous practice of sumac causé, or buen vivir, which means good living, in harmony with our communities, ourselves, and our environment. The concept of buen vivir was even embedded into the Ecuadorian constitution under the presidency of Rafael Correa. Similar concepts are Swaraj from India and Ubuntu from Southern Africa. An example of a newly emergent alternative to development is the degrowth movement. These other ways of living are not just theoretical, but are being put into practice by communities around the world. For example, women farmers practicing agroecology in India. Kotari and his colleagues have launched a website, the Global Tapestry of Alternatives, to allow these different communities to network with each other and share skills, knowledge, and experience. I asked Kotari about the received wisdom that the Global South needs to pursue development projects with the economic expansion and ecological destruction that comes with them in order to overcome poverty.
I think we don't need the same models for meeting people's needs in the Global South that the Global North has used. Again, let's take agriculture. Instead of going into the chemical industrialized agriculture, which causes huge carbon emissions and all sorts of other problems, small farmer biodiversity-based organic farming actually can create food security and sovereignty without causing the same ecological and climate problems. You can do the same with energy. Decentralized renewables can actually meet people's energy needs without causing sorts of problems that centralized systems have caused or fossil fuels have caused. So I think in every sector you can actually find these sorts of alternatives which will undermine this argument that the Global South's rise above deprivation and poverty will have a huge ecological impact on the earth.
In our era of global pandemic, escalating ecological breakdown, inequality and division, it's essential to get to grips with the global, economic and political structures driving these processes. And whether it's by putting pressure on our governments to tax corporations properly or back out of toxic trade treaties, demanding more democratic structures, or by getting involved with alternative community economies on the ground, there are ways we can all be part of creating something new.
Thank you for listening to this Our Voices podcast from Open Democracy. If you enjoyed this podcast and would encourage others to listen, why not head to iTunes, subscribe, and leave us a review? Open Democracy is an independent global media platform that is only possible because of your kind donations. To find out more or to make a donation, head to opendemocracy.net.